Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Paul Wagner here, host of WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place. If you like what you hear, we hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple. That helps us get discovered by other people interested in true crime podcasts. Now, to this week's episode. Previously on WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place.
I was actually in shock. I couldn't believe it. I was hysterical to the point where my family told me that he wasn't dead.
I looked at my text and it said hit. You know, I just it was just a flood of emotions.
He was leaving his residence. We don't know where he was going. And when the officers attempted to stop him immediately after he left his driveway, he immediately produced two guns.
This vital closure that your team has given me makes me finally able to say, happy birthday, Dad. You can now, after 28 years, finally rest in peace.
In July of 2020, the first time I sat down with Detective Bernie Nelson to talk about the murder of Sherry Crandall for this podcast, he surprised me with a piece of news, a stunning piece of news, something he wanted to talk about right away. Detective Nelson told me the killer's DNA was now leading the investigation in a new direction, and it looked like genealogy may be the key to solving the case.
It was not until recently when we sent the DNA to the FBI and Bodie to have more work done that Bodie responded as far as doing familial DNA testing, that they were able to come up with a profile in which they were able to narrow it down to second to fourth cousins in the family tree DNA database.
That's right. Bodie Technology Group, the company the FBI works with to help solve criminal cases using genealogy, had identified distant relatives of the killer by running his DNA through a family tree database. I certainly knew about genealogy and the success law enforcement was having nationwide in closing very difficult cold cases, but this hit me like a bolt of lightning. An investigation that had no hope for years suddenly had new energy. Remember, in 2016, the killer's DNA had been removed from CODIS, the national DNA database used by law enforcement agencies, because it didn't meet the FBI's new standards. A terrible blow at the time because it meant there was no chance for a cold hit if the killer's DNA was suddenly entered into the database by one of the prison systems, a jail, or another law enforcement agency. But now, 4 years after it was dumped from CODIS, Detective Nelson had something new to work with, a genuine and scientific connection with the killer's relatives, as distant as they might be.
There is a lot of promise there. It's more... This is more promising than anything that I've had in the last 22 years.
That's what Bernie told me back in July of 2020. What Bodie Technology Group turned over to the Prince George's County Police was a report that included names of people in the databases they searched who had DNA in common with the killer. At that point, Bodie's work was done. It was now up to Detective Nelson and his team to put the pieces together.
We do know that a 99% chance that it's West African descent is what we're being told, and it's in the second to fourth cousin range. So there are a number of families that we have to go through in order to pinpoint exactly.
There's a lot of legwork.
It's a lot of legwork, a lot of research that has to be done.
And how are you going to do that?
We do have someone that has some expertise in that field. She's been successful in the past, and we can only hope that she's successful in this case. As I said before, she can't make any promises, but it's something that that we can work with, and it's something that gives us hope.
Bernie told us the genealogist on his team is a civilian member of the police force who doesn't work full-time for the cold case unit. The genealogy work she's doing is part-time because it's something she's good at. He asked us not to identify her by name. What happens next is a lot of good old-fashioned detective work, connecting the dots and getting the puzzle pieces to fit just right. Imagine if someone pulled out your family tree with all of your immediate family, cousins, grandparents, their siblings, their children, etc. There might be hundreds, if not thousands, of people connected to you. What Bernie said at the beginning of this episode becomes incredibly important here. He said the Bodie Technology Group had identified relatives of the killer in the second to fourth cousin range. However, he later learned the relatives Bodie identified were actually third to fourth cousins of the killer. For context, third cousins are people who have great-great-grandparents in common, which means fourth cousins share great-great-great-grandparents. That's a lot of people to go through and rule out or rule in. But that is the task the genealogist on Bernie's team now finds herself confronted with. It's a lot of searching through records, birth records, death records, marriage licenses, you name it, and time spent at the library trying to make connections. We asked Detective Nelson what else he could tell us about the killer's relatives Bodie had identified. Where do they live? How old are they? Do they have any connection to the Prince George's County, Maryland area? But Detective Nelson couldn't share that information right now since this is an active investigation. What we can share is a little bit more on the woman working with Bernie to examine the family tree information they were given by Bodie. As Bernie told us, her work has helped solve cases before. One case is that of Matthew Mickens Murray. It was just before 3 p.m. on Tuesday, May 30th, 2017, when the Prince George's County Police were asked to check on the welfare of Matthew. Mickens Murray was a 26-year-old security guard who lived in an apartment on Newton Street in Hyattsville, Maryland. When officers entered the apartment, they found a dreadful scene. Mickens Murray was lying face down on the living room floor in a pool of blood. He had been stabbed 36 times. Friends told a reporter with the Washington Blade that Mickens Murray was last seen at a gay bar in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, May 28th. Crime scene technicians found a bloody fingerprint inside the apartment, along with what investigators believed was the killer's DNA. But the investigation stalled when detectives could not link a suspect to the murder. Just like the Sherry Crandall case, police had DNA and a fingerprint, but when they ran them through their various law enforcement databases, there were zero matches. Approximately 2 years went by before a decision was made to use genealogy to see if they could track the killer through his relatives. It worked. Turns out, according to a court affidavit filed in the case, a few hours after Matthew Mickens Murray was murdered, a man named Brandon Biagas showed up at the Charles Regional Medical Center in La Plata, Maryland. He had a bad cut to his left hand and claimed he had been assaulted by a man while giving him some weed. Deputies from the Charles County Sheriff's Office were called to investigate and found numerous inconsistencies with the story Biagas was telling. They also couldn't find a crime scene. Suspicious of the story the 19-year-old was telling them, deputies got a search warrant for Biagas' truck and found a bloody knife inside, a discovery that demanded further answers. But when investigators paid Biagas another visit, he decided not to cooperate and refused to answer any questions. Since the knife was found during a search warrant, the sheriff's office kept it as evidence, a key that would unlock the case 3 years later. Here's how. Once the genealogy research done by Detective Nelson's colleague revealed Brandon Biagas as a good lead in the murder of Mickens Murray, detectives in Prince George's County ran his name through a law enforcement database. That's when they found the supposed assault case in which the teen had refused to cooperate. An incredible twist of good fortune, since the sheriff's office still had the knife they had found in Biagas' truck. And when the lab was able to examine the blade, police say it contained the blood of both Brandon Biagas and Matthew Mickens Murray. Biagas has been indicted and is now awaiting trial for murder. At a virtual news conference in November of 2020, the Prince George's County State's Attorney's Office announced the launch of a pilot project the county would be undertaking using genealogy to solve cold cases. Bob Dean, the senior prosecutor handling cold cases in the state's attorney's office, spoke that day. He used the Biagas case as an example of what the county was capable of.
A family tree was built out based upon familial traits that were discovered during the course of the forensic genealogy aspect of the case. And it was kind of a team effort, because not only did a private company help build the family tree, but then it was turned over to someone in the department who has experience in ancestry tracing. And as a result of the ancestry tracing that took place, we were able to develop some leads that ultimately led to an arrest and an indictment of this 3.5-year-old murder. And we hope to use the experience of that case in helping us fine-tune our efforts over the course of the next 3 years during the course of this pilot project. I would like to also mention that 2 weeks ago, Sergeant McDonald and Agent Kevin McDonald, both of the cold case homicide unit, and I went up to the FBI and met with a team that has been put together to assist local departments in the family tree build-out. And they are very anxious to support our efforts in this labor-intensive aspect of things. So I think that we're going to learn a lot over the next 3 years.
What's interesting to note about the Mickens-Murray and Sherry Crandall cases is that police closed in on Biagas around the same time Detective Nelson was hearing from the Bodie Technology Group that its efforts to find a possible link to Sherry's killer had paid off. Could one success possibly lead to another?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
When I first began working on this podcast, I had no idea the Prince George's County Police were working on a plan to use genealogy in the Sherry Crandall case. I knew it had been used with great success in a number of local cold cases, but I was pretty clueless on how it really worked. I wanted to know what the Bodie Technology Group was doing. In June of 2020, about a month before I met with Detective Nelson, Bodie put out a press release with this headline, quote, "Continued cold case success leads to expansion of Bodie's forensic genealogy team." The release said, quote, "Bodie continues to deliver investigative leads to law enforcement and attorneys through proven forensic genealogy and DNA analysis methods," unquote. The release went on to cite its work in helping law enforcement identify suspects in a number of cold cases, including a serial rape case in Connecticut and a 1999 murder in Portland, Oregon. It's the same work being done by Parabon Nanolabs, the Virginia company that gave the Montgomery County Police the leads it needed to track down the man who killed shopkeeper James Essel. So I got in touch with Teresa Vreeland, Bodie's Director of Forensic Genealogy. She was willing to talk about the work the private lab was doing, but was not permitted to discuss the Crandall case. I wanted to know more about how the lab goes about its work. What ancestry databases are used, and how does Bodie submit the criminal's DNA for comparison to everyone else in the database?
So once we have that file format for upload, in FamilyTree, you submit your data to them. They make sure that it meets the quality requirements, and they would put it into their database, the FamilyTree DNA database. GEDmatch is the other database that allows law enforcement searching, and that one you upload on your own. And so I have a user account. I would complete that upload. Takes about a day to complete searching, and then I can start visually looking all through my results.
So how quickly do you get results returned? And when you get them, what does it say to you? I mean, can you sort of describe it to me, what it looks like? Is it like in a printout, or does it give you names of individuals?
So once we upload to the database, you're usually looking about that 24 to 48 hour mark where you get the searching is complete. The DNA testing itself obviously takes time, but just as far as the upload, it takes 1 to 2 days. And our results is a list of names. They can be aliases. The people uploading their sample chooses what they put there. It doesn't have to be their legal name. And sometimes we'll be able to see an email address that they associate with that account. And so again, it can be one they're using all the time, or it can be one they created just for that upload. You know, there's no requirements as far as that email address goes.
Vreeland says from the results, she can see how much DNA is in common with the suspect the police are looking for.
Which begins to give you an idea of how closely related they are, whether it's a second cousin or maybe a sibling, you know, depending on what that works out to be. So now we have a name or an alias, an email address, which is sometimes useful, sometimes not, and an idea of how closely related that person is to our sample.
In the summer of 2020, after Detective Nelson had given Bodie a sample of the killer's DNA, he was told by the lab that its search had found a connection as close as a third cousin, information that came in the form of a report from the lab. I asked Teresa Vreeland to tell me what a report like that might look like.
From Bodie, we issue a report that states what work was done, the quality of the work, you know, we confirmed. And then we give a screenshot, an image of those matches. And then we give them our recommendations. So we do an initial screening of those matches. Do we have someone related closely enough?
Vreeland says her team will then recommend whether the results are good enough to go forward with the research, or the investigation should wait to see if closer matches can be made at another time. What surprised me is the fact the results discovered by Bodie came from a relatively small universe of samples. GEDmatch and FamilyTree USA, the two companies that allow law enforcement to search its databases, only have combined the genetic footprints of about 2 million people. That's less than it used to be. Here's why. I understand that GEDmatch, at one time, you had to opt out if you didn't want to keep your DNA in, and now it's an automatic opt out. What kind of a hurdle was that for you, and did it really set back some cases in trying to get family trees?
It really did. So you're exactly right. It started when you would upload your DNA, it was automatically opted in to law enforcement matching, meaning if a law enforcement was searching their sample, you were available for matching with them, you know, if your sample did match. You're not visible until you do match. So I can't look in GEDmatch and see a list of everyone who's using it. I only can see people my sample matches with. And so you are available for that matching. And it was in early 2019 that GEDmatch did a full reset. They opted everyone out and you had to be opted back in. And that's your own personal choice. And so it was a really huge hurdle because we overnight instantly went down, you know, from say you had 30 matches to none, you know, or even more than 30, you're down to none. So all of a sudden, all of our cases have zero matches. Ugh. And so you're basically right back to before you even started your testing. You know, you all of a sudden have no more information. And it was pretty quick that people that are firm believers in the law enforcement using this technology, they were quick to come and opt in. But there's a lot of people who, you know, maybe tried doing their ancestry years ago and they have no interest to even log back into GEDmatch, or maybe they are deceased since they did their upload, or, you know, so many countless reasons you can think about. They don't care to come in just to opt their sample back in. And so the database still is, you know, far smaller than it was before that happened. But it is, on the flip side, it's nice to give the community, you know, that confidence that they have that choice and, you know, nothing is happening without their consent. So it kind of is nice to give that comfortability back, because the privacy is a big concern.
In order to search those databases, there are also rules Bodhi must follow.
The first step we take together is looking at their case as a whole. The genealogy field, the two databases that allow for law enforcement access or matching, they are very specific in that they require violent crimes, so mostly homicide and rape, and also unidentified remains. So the very first thing I do is I make sure their case meets that eligibility, that criteria.
In Sherry's case, Detective Nelson and his team have now been mining the data turned over by Bodhi for the last 10 months, probing the information they've been given in hopes of finally closing in on Sherry's killer. As you've been listening to this podcast, you've heard Detective Nelson discuss nearly every aspect of the case. You've heard him say he's felt pressure to solve it, and that hardly a day goes by that he doesn't wonder if there wasn't something he may have missed. You've heard him talk about the crime solver's flyer from Sherry's case that still hangs at his work desk. It's somewhat unusual for a detective to hold on to an investigation for as long as Bernie has. Murders that have gone unsolved for this long usually get turned over to another investigator for what police like to call a second set of eyes. But former homicide commander Mike McQuillan says many investigators have taken a look at Sherry's case, not just Bernie.
With the evidence that we have and the advances that we have in the investigative process, I am shocked that we haven't found the person responsible for Sherry Crandall's murder. Shocked. Because I know the efforts that have been put forth to bring that closure to the family. And I am shocked it hasn't happened as of yet. But I still have faith, and I still believe it's going to close. I mean, I stayed for cases that I wanted to make sure closed. And I stayed 31 years. Bernie's longer than that. There's been many, many eyes that have looked at this case. It's not all of Bernie's. Bernie's the coordinator. In fact, to be honest with you, a lot of cases where all the main detective is just putting the case file together. Everybody else is the worker bees. It's not always the case, but that's not the case in this case, but The case detective is the coordinator to put that together for successful prosecution. Dot the I's and cross the T's. And there's more than two eyes have looked at this case for 22 years, guaranteed, because you're looking at two of them right now.
You took a look at it, very hard look at it as well.
For a long time.
Yeah.
Up until the day I left. And I still ask, Bernie, how's that case?
What would it mean to you to see this case closed?
Just like any other case. I mean, when Stephanie Watson case closed and Bernie and them were able to successfully bring that to closure with DNA, I can't wait for that celebration. I can't wait to talk to Darren.
You just heard Mike McQuillan mention the Stephanie Watson case. Stephanie went missing from Prince George's County in 1982, and it took the cold case team 31 years to find her killer. But in 2013, they were able to make this announcement at a news conference.
Good afternoon. My name is Sergeant Rick Fulginiti, spelled F-U-L-G-I-N-I-T-I. And I'm happy to announce the case closure of a 1982 homicide of Stephanie Sue Watson. Stephanie lived in Laurel, was a 27-year-old woman. She was single at the time. She left her home to go to work that evening. She was going to run a few errands and then go to work. She worked at Laurel Beltsville Hospital, it was called at that time. Stephanie never made it to work. Her coworkers called her house, and there was no answer. The next day, she was to have traveled to Pennsylvania to meet her cousin, and they were going to spend the weekend together before she permanently moved to Dallas, Texas. She never showed up to see her cousin. Her cousin became concerned, and she was then classified as a missing persons with the Laurel Police Department. Laurel Police Department handled the case for several months. Several days later, they located her vehicle. The vehicle was soaked with blood. They continued to work the case until September 3rd, when body parts were found. A young man saw a vehicle pull up, drop something into the woods. When he went to investigate, he saw what he believed to be human bones, and he notified the police.
The case went cold until 2013, when Detective Nelson decided to take another look at the seat from the car. It was still in the police department's evidence warehouse, where it had been since 1982. When Bernie examined an area of the seat the driver would not have been able to reach, he found blood that belonged to a convicted rapist.
We've spoken to the family. They're very happy that they finally have some closure. And it's certainly our goal within the cold case unit to eventually give that same satisfaction to everyone who lost a loved one.
The DNA profile developed from that evidence was a match to John Ernest Walsh, who pleaded guilty to murder and was sentenced to 33 years in prison. Bernie and his partner, Tony Schartner, also solved what came to be known as the mother-daughter murders, two vicious crimes that had the Prince George's County community gripped by fear. At the time in 2009, police could not explain why Dolores DeWitt, 42, and her 20-year-old daughter were both found dead in a burning, stolen car 6 weeks after Karen Lofton, 42, and her 16-year-old daughter, Carissa, were found shot to death inside their home. There didn't seem to be a motive for the crimes. In fact, the crime scenes were so different, an FBI profiler determined the cases were not linked, and detectives should be looking for two killers. The case finally came together months later when Detective Nelson and his partner zeroed in on a man named Jason Scott, a man with a computer science degree working for UPS. Scott, 27, was first arrested by the ATF and charged with selling guns out of the trunk of his car before police found evidence at an old abandoned mansion they say linked Scott to at least one of the murder scenes. Bernie does not give up. It's why he went back to the FBI all these years later to try one last time to solve Sherry's murder. It's why he hasn't retired. It's why he agreed to do this podcast. When Bernie's former boss, Mike McQuillan, and I sat down for an interview in the summer of 2020, he already knew about the effort to use genealogy in the Crandall case.
So what did you think when you heard that?
Let's find him. Let's put forth every effort now, just like every effort was put forth on the 13th of January, 1998. Let's keep that going. Don't slow down. Keep going. And call when you get a suspect.
And 22 years later, you still have confidence this might close?
I hope and pray every case closes. And I hope and pray this is one of them. Prince George's County needs to bring closure. The family needs closure. Sherry Crandall needs closure.
In December of 2020, I was able to interview Detective Nelson a second time. We had agreed to meet outside the Prince George's Hospital Center, where Bernie was going to give me a copy of the interview with hospital housekeeper Edna Brown, the woman who said she saw a man in a white lab coat attacking Sherry. It had been 5 months since Bernie told me about the search in the Ancestry databases, and I was anxious to learn if he and his team had made any progress. We talked in the Garden of Hope and Peace, dedicated to Sherry's memory.
Well, the person who's doing it for us is very good. She's spending a lot of hours working on it. But it's a process. It's a very long process. You might get lucky and get a quick result. However, we're coming up with numerous family trees that we have to go down. And we're looking at third and fourth cousins, so that requires a lot of work in order to bring it home as far as identifying a possible suspect or a possible immediate family that we have to look into. So it's a long, drawn-out process. I don't expect any quick results. I can only pray that we'll get something that we can work with.
And there's been some movement. Detective Nelson told me he's gotten new DNA samples from people who may have some connection to the killer.
I didn't have to get search warrants. They were cooperative. But it could be somebody in their family. It doesn't necessarily have to be them. What we're dealing with are a lot of last names. It doesn't mean that the DNA actually came from that person, but as far as the names that they're dealing with in the family tree, if we find someone with a similar last name or the same last name, I will track that person down and get their DNA and ask them questions about their relatives. It's a lot of legwork. You have to look at a lot of birth certificates, a lot of marriage licenses through GEDmatch, and link people together if you can. Some of these family members are not in the local area. They're in different states across the country. So I've had to make a lot of phone calls and talk to people in different states and ask them questions about their family members. And fortunately, so far, everyone has been forthcoming. They're actually surprised that their DNA submissions that they made to some of these data banks actually drew any interest from law enforcement. So they're actually willing to cooperate, fortunately, in my case.
When I first approached Bernie about telling Sherry's story in a podcast series, he was initially skeptical. He had never listened to a podcast. He said to me, "I don't know who the audience is." So at that December meeting, I was surprised to learn he had begun listening to podcasts and now had a different outlook.
I've been listening to nothing but podcasts for the last couple of weeks, thanks to you. They're very interesting. They captivate you. They keep you involved. I've actually listened to two of them twice now because they're very interesting. But I just hope that this podcast would gain someone's interest, that a lot of people will listen to it, and they can go back and listen to it again if they miss something. But I hope it just jars some memories and actually push people to call us. And they can call us anonymously. They don't have to tell us who they are. But they can call us anonymously and give us whatever information they may have. It doesn't matter if you think it's important or if you think it will lead anywhere. Just give it to us and let us figure that out.
After the first episode of Murder in a Safe Place dropped in late February, people did begin to call. Detective Nelson says three people phoned in tips to Crime Solvers, the first time any tips have come into Crime Solvers on this case in 23 years. Another person left a message in a Facebook group discussing the case, and still another called the WTOP newsroom. The specifics of those tips I was asked not to disclose due to the active nature of the investigation and due to the fact that right now they're just unverified tips. If any of them pan out, rest assured, I will share them with you in a future episode. The murder of Sherry Crandall has left a mark on people who knew her well. Remember Shirley Montague, Sherry's secretary at the hospital? She told me the crime sometimes, out of the blue, will just drift across her mind.
It's a mystery.
It is a total mystery. I think about it often. Once in a while, I always go back to it. What happened?
Yeah.
What happened and why?
It's a question that haunts others as well. People who knew Sherry, friends of the Crandall kids, and their parents who lived in Bowie, Maryland at the time Sherry was murdered. Many of them, after seeing publicity and listening to the podcast, began leaving comments for the Crandalls on social media. One woman wrote, "Listened yesterday and my heart was hurting. I really hope that justice for her will be served and you all can finally get the peace you all deserve from her loss. May her memory be a blessing." Another wrote, "Tears in my eyes listening to Darren. It's been so long, so many memories returned." And then there was this. "I listened to the podcast yesterday. It was chilling. I had heard many years ago what happened to your mom, but didn't know the details. How horrible. For her, for your family, and for those that loved her. You are all so strong." The murder haunted Edna Brown as well, the housekeeper who told police she walked in on the attack and didn't know if the man in the white lab coat was helping Sherry or hurting her. You heard from Edna Brown in episode 2 when she was interviewed by a psychiatrist 3 months after the murder. After telling the doctor what she witnessed, Edna paused and then said she was horrified that someone could be murdered inside a hospital.
"Can I tell you something, doctor? See, when I go home at night, I pray, but I find myself crying.
I wonder if you could talk to your boss about getting
out of it. I would cry. And my sheep say, maybe after a while, you'll get over it.
I can't somebody get over something like that, doctor.
That was tough. Especially in a hospital.
Don't expect something like that to happen.
A hospital where you say people laugh."
What's also extraordinary is that 23 years after the murder, Detective Nelson says whenever he's at the hospital, people still stop and ask him about the crime.
"People are still afraid. People still ask me questions about this
today
case." "Yes, today. They still ask me questions."
When I first sat down with Luke Crandall, Sherry's youngest child, in March of 2020, neither of us knew about the new direction Detective Nelson was taking the case. At the time, I asked him what it would mean if he suddenly got a call from Detective Nelson one day telling him the case had been closed.
"I would probably cry. And I would probably tell him that I would have to call him back. I would call my wife or find my wife. And I would sit with her for a long while. And her and I would probably not talk at all. But we would know exactly what each other was thinking. And then I would call Bernie back. And I would, I'd probably tell him that I love you." And, it was the end to a horrific nightmare that, changed my life forever.
Only a few days separated my interview with Luke and the one I had with Tiffany in March of 2020, so again, neither of us knew what was happening with the case, and like Luke, I wanted to know her thoughts on what it would be like to finally know what happened to her mom.
"My brothers and I have talked about, you know, the why. Why for this long have we not had an answer? And I do think that we feel like, for whatever reason, in some way, we weren't meant to know it until now. But we're ready now. And I think whether it's emotionally or mentally or just how where we are in our lives, We are ready. We want that answer. And you hear all the time about, you know, something someone knew, that guilt, that burden that they've been carrying, and, you know, they hear something or they, something's triggered them and they realize, like, I need to come forward, I need to say something. And we are hopeful that someone will hear this podcast or hear of it, hear about it, and just say, let me listen, let me hear what happened to those three kids. Let me see if I can help to give closure. And that is what we're hoping for.
I posed the same question to Darren. What would it mean to finally know what happened to your mom?
If you could think of the most important thing that you've ever done in your life, that you thought was the most important thing, whether it was having your first kid or, you know, someone survives a traumatic injury or someone overcomes an illness, and that just made you, you know, you couldn't be happier than anything else. There's nothing happier in your life you ever experienced. This thing would surpass that by like 10 times. It would be something where, you know, it would be like a justice done type of thing, where now I know the person that has been out there, maybe they've committed other crimes that they've gotten away with, and that person is now caught, and they're not going to victimize anybody else. So that'd be the first thing, that the community, the world, if you will be safer because this person is caught. And then being able to look at them and say, you know, after all this time, you know, you thought you got away with it all this time, and now you didn't. Now we got you. And the other thing is finding the closure for everybody involved, not just the three of us, but like every member of our family, my mom's side of the family, my dad's side of the family. Everybody has a little bit of closure somewhere in this. And the people that she worked with, the hospital staff, some of the nurses she was friends with, our neighbors, I mean, all these people that saw this thing happen, they all experienced it in their own way too. And this will give them sort of closure as well, not just the three of us. You know, selfishly, we want it done, but there's lots of other people, hundreds of other people that were affected by this. And when they see that and understand that, they're going to have the same sense of accomplishment, that 10 times better than accomplishment I'm talking about.
You've heard Detective Nelson say that he's felt pressure to close this case, that he's haunted by it, that it's his case to solve. Sherry Crandall, he says, is never far from his mind.
It's frustrating that it's still open. It's frustrating that we're still in the same position we were on January 13th, 1998, when this took place. We can only hope and pray that we can finally identify a suspect and bring this case to a close. I can't give it up. It's mine. And, you know, I hope that it closes before I actually leave this department. I would like to be able to call the family and let them know that we finally identified who's responsible. That's the reward that I would get for closing it. But it's definitely my case and will always be my case, even after I leave.
Over the course of research and writing this podcast series, I've had many conversations with Detective Nelson. We've talked on the phone, exchanged text messages and emails. He has never ducked a question and has been there every time I needed to check a fact. In our last conversation on March 24th, 2021, just 5 days before this podcast episode was to drop, Bernie told me the genealogist working the case was making progress and had identified a family tree that appeared to have more promise than any of the others she had looked at so far. He also told me he had a new name to track down and was that day going out for some interviews and perhaps obtaining some new DNA samples. So that's about as much as I can tell you right now about the murder of Sherry Crandall and the long, exhaustive search for her killer. We will release more episodes of this podcast as Bernie and his team uncover more information. Over the next 2 weeks, I'm going to bring you an interview I did just this past weekend with Luke, Darren, Tiffany, and Bernie. You might not believe this, but it's the first time ever all of the Crandall kids have sat down with Bernie together. In fact, Luke Crandall had never spoken to Bernie before this interview. I hope you'll all tune in. As I've told you throughout the podcast, in the year I've spent on this project, I have learned things along the way that have surprised and stunned me. But I was in for one more surprise when I visited Sherry's grave in Bowie, Maryland in February of 2021. It was a brisk, cold, but bright, beautiful day. In all these years, I had never been there before.
I didn't know exactly where her grave was. I wandered through the cemetery here for a few minutes. Tiffany told me what color it was, and that did stand out. And it's a pink tombstone, and I just found it. Tiffany tells me that she designed this grave marker, and it's in a long line of grave markers here, and it's in the last row in the cemetery up against a tree line. And it says Cheryl Ann Willis, January 7, 1948 to January 13th, 1998. And then just below that, it says her ways are ways of pleasantness and all her paths are peace. And I know Tiffany took great pride in designing this for her mom. I'm taken by the first few words there. Her ways are ways of pleasantness. And that's all I've heard about when people have talked about Sherry Crandall. One other note. I had no idea that Sherry is buried next to John Novobilsky. This is one of the most troubling murders I ever covered in this county. John Novobilsky was a police officer who was working a special assignment outside a liquor store when a man who was just angry at the world and angry at the police just walked up on him and shot him dead as he sat in his patrol car. And I had no idea that he was buried here. There are two badges above his name just saying Novobilsky. And then down below it says John Joseph, April 25, 1964 to April 26, 1995. I'll never, ever, ever forget that murder. And to have these two incredible people and innocent people who were murdered lying in rest next to each other is it's very sobering to see. And you know, they solved John Novobilsky's murder, but not Sherry's. So here's hope that that will change.
Murder in a Safe Place, Season 2 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, has been written and produced by me, Paul Wagner, and CaseJackets.com. Like what you're hearing so far? Please take a moment to subscribe and leave a review on Apple. That helps us get discovered by other people interested in true crime podcasts. We have more on the Sherry Crandall case, including photos of the family, the videotaped interview with witness Edna Brown, and behind-the-scenes footage with me on our website, AmericanNightmarePodcast.com. Reporting and production of this podcast was supported by a grant from Spotlight DC, Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism. For grants, please apply to spotlightdc.org. Have a question you'd like to see answered in a future show? Email me at paul@wtop.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @AMNightmarePod and on Facebook at facebook.com/AMNightmarePod. If you know anything about the murder of Sherry Crandall, you're asked to call Crime Solvers at 866-411-TIPS. That's 866-411-TIPS. This podcast series would not be possible without the help of Sherry's three children, the Prince George's County Police,
Shirley Montague, Detective Bernie Nelson, and Mike McQuillan. Editorial assistance from Julia Ziegler and Craig Schwab. Music for this episode is Runway 47 by Immersive Music and Flum Flum by Up North Music. Subscribe today on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.